Hey, here is another episode of Old School Guns, the podcast that tells you everything you want to know and tells you straight like it is. We have no sponsors, we have no network that tells us what to do, so basically everything you hear from me is the unvarnished truth as I see it. So let's get right to the first subject we're going to talk about today. If this is your first time listening to the podcast, I just wanted to let you know that we usually put it into three segments. One segment is about Second Amendment news and current news. The next one is about critiquing the current gun culture, some of the stuff we see, which is garbage or really good, and we tell you like it is on that. And the third segment is questions and answers, and those are questions that I garner up either over the internet through comments or that people ask me personally. So those are the three segments of the podcast. And our first topic today is the Walmart situation. As you well know, Walmart, after the shooting in El Paso, they were kind of quiet. Then I guess it's the liberal factions of the remaining Walton family, which essentially control the corporation. They have basically decided to do a couple of different things. And one is that even though in Alaska they were still selling handguns, because handguns are used up there as a protection against dangerous animals, they've decided to stop selling handguns everywhere, including Alaska. They have also decided not to encourage, and they've asked people not to open carry firearms inside their stores. Now, what that really entails, I don't know. I mean, if you do it, do they just ask you, please don't do that, or do they remove you from the store? I don't know what the deal is. I think it's ridiculous. I've never seen anybody open carry in a Walmart anyway, so I don't know that that is a big problem anywhere. So they've asked for that, and now they're going to stop selling certain types of handgun and rifle ammunition. As far as I know, it's all handgun ammunition, and rifle ammunition they're no longer going to sell. 223-556, 7.62x39, or 7.62x51. And I assume that that translates also into 308 Winchester. But I don't know, because 308 Winchester is a legit hunting round. They say they want to continue to service their hunting customers, which was the whole intent of their gun program. Anyway, blah, 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 blah. Well, first of all, I think there needs to be some truth on Walmart's part. Walmart, you know, doesn't make a lot of money selling guns or ammunition. And, you know, buying either of those in there, I've never bought a gun in Walmart, but I have bought some ammunition from time to time. It's been kind of a convenient place where, hey, if I know I'm going out the next day to the range with a guest, I can buy some throwaway Tull ammo 5.56, you know, that kind of stuff, inexpensive. Or if I find that I've miscalculated and I don't have, I'm running short of ammunition, I can buy some there. It's fairly close to my range, so it was a pretty convenient place and for emergency purchases. Plus, you never really know what they're going to have. They, you know, a lot of times they're sold out of this, but they have that. It's not really a place that had a very stable supply. You can usually find the caliber you want, but if you wanted a certain type of ammo, it was, you know, hit or miss whether they would have the exact bullet weight or the manufacturer that you really wanted. So that's the story on Walmart. No real gun enthusiasts I know of really buy much there. Yeah, they sell earplugs. They sell some real, and I mean real low-end accessories, you know. they have holsters in there. They have some leather holsters in there. And I looked at that and I go, what is this? And it was such a cheap leather holster. It looked like, I don't, you know, you get better from a prison inmate. I mean, prison inmates that work leather could do a better job than this. This was the cheapest, ugliest, and I would even say that it was not well made or sturdy. I certainly wouldn't put even a lousy gun in it. So they've got a lot of low-end accessories. The other reason is, you know, you get that Walmart level of service of you got to go find somebody. They got to unlock the cabinet, take out what you want, ring you up right there, because they don't trust you to run around the store with this stuff. Getting counter service is just absolutely horrible. I mean, it's so much better to go somewhere else. But occasionally I would do it. I never tried to buy a firearm there because I just can imagine the circus it must be. I mean, it's tough enough in Cabela's. You know, usually the smaller shops, you know, there's a guy, he kind of takes care of you. Cabela's, it's, you know, they put you on the machine. I don't know what they do in Walmart, but I can't imagine that it's anything other than just agony of ill-trained employees that hardly know what to do and just a real problem. So I never purchased a firearm there. They don't have any firearms I would really want. I mean, they have, it's like everything else in Walmart. It's all low end, very, very low end. And I strongly suspect the stuff I've seen in there, I think manufacturers basically have a Walmart-only model of certain guns. Because I've seen stuff in there that I've never seen anywhere else. And it's really low-ended. Like, it'd be a 10/22 with a really, really poor quality, just unattractive. Not really poor quality, but unattractive stock, you know. You could tell it's the basic base model. And it's just, it's not a nice piece of wood on there. It's functional and it's there, but you can tell it's inexpensive. Same thing with the Remington rifles and some of the other things I've seen there. I've just seen models there that I've never really, don't really see anywhere else. And I think that some of these manufacturers make these just for Walmart and maybe some other kind of, you know, low-end stores too. I mean, maybe they do that. Maybe they have a whole line, maybe there's a secret code on the model number or something that tells you you're getting the dog. And usually the action, and I'm sure the action and barrel are fine. So if you're going to get a gun to customize like a 10/22 and put a fancy stock on it, maybe replace the barrel and trigger, it's probably just great. It's probably a smart gun to buy for that because you're not paying for a lot of extra stuff that you're just going to take off and stick in a closet somewhere. So those are the kind of guns there. The only guy I know who actually bought a gun from Walmart was a working acquaintance of mine who, the guy wasn't really a hunter, but thought he might go hunting with some of his friends. So he went in and bought, you know, a Remington, kind of the 788 or 798, you know, the budget Remington rifle that came with the scope already, you know, came with the very inexpensive 3-9 scope. And, you know, it's kind of one of those things. It looks like a deer rifle. And I'm sure, you know, for the hunting around here, it's certainly fine. In the Midwest, there's a lot of tree stand hunting and close ranges, so it'd be fine for here, but it's certainly not something that you'd want to take into the Rockies or British Columbia and go after the trophy doll sheep or something. It was definitely not that. It was definitely a very pedestrian and probably useful, but not particularly anything that would thrill a gun enthusiast. The only thing that I ever saw in there that was remotely interesting was, I think it was a 24-inch heavy barrel 243, which, you know, could have been the basis of a customized precision rifle. But, you know, that was going to be another project you pour dollars into, and by the time you're done, have you really gained anything? And the answer is, well, you could probably buy for the end cost. If you compared that, you could probably buy something comparable or better with a lot less hassle and everything else. So where this is all going is Walmart was never a great place to get to procure firearms. Walmart, the reason they bailed on all this ammunition is because I think it's a product line that's not making them a lot of money. I think the online retailers are killing them in that way. I think that same thing, you can buy, get good deals on kind of, you know, very utilitarian and pedestrian guns other places. So I don't think, you know, I just think they just sort of have the line there. And when they saw an opportunity to bail on the ammunition. And you know, ammunition is kind of a labor-intensive thing. It actually has to be sorted by caliber. They might have to give, you know, some of their employees like half a day of training so they know the difference between a 45 and a 38 and, you know, a few things like that. So other than that, is Walmart a great loss? No. Do I like the precedent it sets? Well, no, I like that even less. And frankly, I'm punishing Walmart. I told you in the last podcast, hey, my tires are getting bought from somewhere else. And all the things that I was kind of buying in there, little nickety-nackety things, little tools and all this kind of stuff. Hey, guess what? I'm buying that somewhere else now. Someone else is going to get the money, and Walmart can basically go fly a kite. Okay, after talking about the bad people, Walmart, let's talk about somebody I've mentioned before who are good, good people, who have great products, they're a lot of fun, and they're reasonably priced. And that is redheadedt-shirts.com. And if you put all that in your bar and click it, it'll bring up their website, or I imagine you can Google search them and find them. They've got some very funny morale patches, you know, Elmer Fudd with an AR-15, you know, all kinds of good stuff like that. Plus, they've got great t-shirts, and what I like about them is, you know, their t-shirts don't cost an arm and a leg. I mean, I like some of Ranger Up stuff. You know, Ranger Up makes great t-shirts. So does Grunt Style. They make great t-shirts. But, you know, you can paying over $30 for a t-shirt, man. I mean, you get three t-shirts and you've dropped a C-note. That's a pretty heavy price to pay for three t-shirts. Redheaded T-Shirt Company, they're about $20. So that's about two-thirds of the cost. They're a lot of fun for weapons enthusiasts. They've got a lot of historical type t-shirts and things. I'll let you go on there and browse it if you're interested, but and won't try to describe their catalog to you. But I think they're a really good deal, and it's a really good company to deal with. I've mentioned them before, but I thought that they deserved it again. They usually get a lot of business from me before Christmas time, and they've always come through. So, yeah, redheaded t-shirts are squared away. And, you know, if you really like the FAL, the British stuff, the M1 Garand, M1 Carbine, and all the rest of it, they're the place to go. They're a lot of fun. So I'm not saying the other guys are bad. The other thing I like about them is they're not these thin, clingy, muscle t-shirts, which, as the older we get, the less appealing those shirts are. So these are like just standard regular t-shirts, so they don't cling to your body and try to show off your muscles that you don't have anymore. So anyway, they're really good to deal with, and I can't recommend them highly enough. And no, they are not a sponsor. They've never given me anything for free, and I just want to see them basically do well. But I also want to just tip off my listeners that these guys are out there, and you can get some great stuff from them. So, you know, it's something that a tip I'm passing on to you. Okay, the next thing is, you know, finally, the NRA is getting it together. And if you saw their San Francisco ad, it is awesome. And they stick it right to that filthy communist board of supervisors, those trashy, scummy people in San Francisco. They stick it right to them with ordinary people saying, hey, I'm not a terrorist, and going on. I'm sure if you haven't seen it, you will. But it's a great ad, and it's a great response. And hey, I think the NRA is coming out. They're saying, you know, no inch on any of this. And I think they're right. You know, when people are talking about expanded background checks, I'm like, well, how expanded can these things be? They do a standard background check that's required, and essentially, you know, they can do right there over the phone. They can get it done over the phone. So I think extended background checks are a couple things. Number one, it's going to cost money, so it's going to be a $10 or $15 or $20 or $25 fee, and it's a way that they can discourage people from trying to buy firearms. Number two, it's something where, oh, gee, everybody has to wait now because it takes a couple days to do this. So it's going to be a background check that's going to take 5 days a week, whatever time frame they put on it. And number three, I think they want to force every transfer, even among family members, to go through a dealer and have to put up with the same rigor of the expanded background checks and waiting periods and all the rest. So that's really what's behind that. And the NRA is saying no, no dice. Doesn't work, isn't going to help, no dice. And I think that's the best thing I've heard in a long time. I mean, I really like it. And I've told everyone this before, but go on Facebook and support Willis Lee, W-I-L-L-E-S, last name Lee, L-E-E, second vice president of the NRA, good guy, a good dude, and basically just check in, give him a good comment on his page, and tell him go for it. It's also a good page to subscribe to if you're a Facebook person, because he puts a lot of stuff up there, and a lot of relevant stuff that just coincidentally you don't hear about in the mainstream media. You know, imagine that there's some pro-gun facts out there that they're not really advertising or telling you or bringing to you, because guess what? They have an agenda. They have a complete agenda that is to take your guns, take your money, and they're going to redistribute it. And you see how that's going to work out. You know, little Beto told us they're coming after it. And all those candidates are the same way. Kooks like Elizabeth Warren and even crazy old Joe Biden, crazy old Joe. You know, they're going to have so much pressure from inside their party, they will go along with it. And it's the very, very liberal, very, very radicalized part of their party that's trying to do this. So I would definitely get on there, support Willis Lee, please support the NRA, even if you have reservations about all those things that have come up in the last couple of months. And really, there's not that many, but let's focus on the next election. That's the ball game. That's it. And we lose this, and we will be getting ready to turn things in, and it will not be pretty. And so unless you want your guns bought back with your own money, they'll raise your taxes to buy your guns back. And of course, they're not going to give you market value. So understand that that's what they want, and that's what they're going for. Hey, to shift gears to some gun culture stuff, I've just been watching some of the videos, and I've hit some of these guys pretty hard in the past, but there seems to be a couple of trends that I'm seeing that are, I don't know what to think about them. One is these tactical matches, sometimes called two-gun matches, or some of these, and these things are cropping up all over the place now. In-range TV kind of started them, but they're popping up all over the place. I don't really know what to make of them, other than I'd really like to do some, but frankly, I'm skipping the stages because I'm at that point where I can't really afford to get hurt. But, you know, I'm not throwing kettlebells around. I'm not dragging fakey machine guns or some of this other stuff. Yeah, there's a little bit with dummies they use, which is kind of fine, you know, simulating an injured person that you're evacuating or whatever. That's all kind of fine. Tactically, none of that makes any sense. And scenario-wise, none of that makes any sense. But it's something that they kind of throw in. It's kind of this hodgepodge of skills that are thrown in with some shooting on, you know, usually steel targets type of a deal. But I have to tell them, I don't even know how they get insured. I mean, somebody's really going to bust a gut trying to throw a kettlebell 20 or 30 feet or 10 or 15 yards. Somebody's really going to get hurt doing that. I mean, it's one thing in your 20s to think you can do that, but I've seen some pictures of really young guys who are just, you know, really trying to chuck these things, because apparently the farther you throw it, the farther you can advance and the shorter your shots would be. There's some advantage to that. And there's other things too, you know. I would be very careful. Adding physicality to a rifle match is something that, first of all, I don't know how you insure it, because I just don't know. But second of all, the other thing is it really kind of detracts, and it can depending on how guns are carried and how people are trying to do this enhanced physicality, there could be some increased risk. So I would be very leery of something like that, or trying to throw these types of things in. One of the things we were going to do with our military rifle matches was, some of us were thinking it'd be fun to do a pro mask or gas mask shoot, or at least a stage where, you know, you would, maybe in a course of fire, you'd fire 10 rounds. We eventually decided not to do that, and here's why. It's because you don't know the physical capability of some of the shooters. And there may be guys who really want to do it, but you don't really know if they can put on a mask. Are they going to have trouble breathing? Are they going to pass out? There could be all kinds of problems. The other problem is, some of these surplus masks, you're breathing through some of these filters. You have no idea what's in these filters. You know, like, you know, the old Romanian gas mask may not be something that you really want to huff into your lungs, especially if you're tired. So the surplus masks, especially some that are 50, 60, 70 years old, they're not a really good idea, and especially if somebody is breathing, you know, panting because they've been running around on the range, or because it's hot that day, or for whatever reason. You know, those just aren't great ideas. So those are the kind of things that you can't really do. One of the courses of action we actually came up with but never tried was maybe the paint respirator, you know, like those little respirators you get when people are around very dusty environments, like a grinding wheels and things that put off a lot of particulates in the air. Maybe wearing something like that with goggles, you would simulate a pro mask. But even then, you know, you put that on someone and you just don't know. So a lot of things that sound cool and might be fun to do, can you do them in a match environment? And I would say you have to be very, very careful. Very, very careful of what you do, because there's always someone who's going to think they can do something and maybe they don't have the capacity to perform and do it. So that's one trend I kind of see, is this this kind of making it more of a triathlon or a biathlon type event, where, or decathlon if you've got five stages, where they're physically wearing you out. It's not just the shooting, but it's something else. And as people get older, they're going to be less, their ability to do that is going to decline. And that's all one thing, because at a certain point they can say, hey, I'm not going to do this anymore, and that's fine. But for people trying to break in, somebody might get in over their head. And even some younger people now, you know, we don't have the most fit young people in the world anymore now. So to participate in something like that, there really has to be not only a shooting practice regimen, but also another training regimen to get the rest of you into some sort of shape. If you're young enough, that's really a great thing to do. For older people, again, that kind of increases the risk of something going on, as older people, you know, like me, are wearing out. So, and replacement parts they don't make anymore. So, you know, that's kind of the deal on that. The other thing is the new god that gets worshipped now are optics, and it's especially optics on tactical rifles. Last couple of podcasts we talked about, you know, we talked about the Guerrilla Gunfighter book, and we talked about some of the other things. We had questions about, you know, what is kind of the most efficient carbine to run, and at what distances would you likely be engaging something if you're an armed citizen and you're using it for self-defense. And basically, when you add all those up, you really don't have a tremendous need for optics. They're certainly nice to have, and they're certainly, in some ways, very convenient and easy to use, and present a simplified sight picture. However, I still contend that they're not absolutely essential, and, you know, giving in to the current trend of everything has to have a red dot, or you're just not going to be competitive, or you're just going to be tremendously behind the power curve, or there's some evolution, you're a Luddite, there's this evolution that you have not taken part of. You know, that's just frankly wrong. And a lot of the rifles, you know, and frankly, I'll say almost every rifle other than the AR or its derivatives are very difficult to scope. I mean, they're usually pretty difficult. Now, on the DSA makes great top covers for the FNFAL. There are some, you know, with varying success, mounts for the M1A, the, you know, semi-automatic M14. The G3 is always kind of used the claw mount. I've always found that that works. The Warsaw Pact rails I have had less luck with, but they're okay. They can be made to work. But there's almost always a problem with the comb and cheek, the distance between the top of the comb and the sight. You know, a lot of these rifles were just never designed for an optic, and they were put on as an afterthought. Because it, that way you still had a standard rifle and it could fulfill two roles, that of a sniper, what we call a DMR these days, and that of a standard infantry rifle. So, you know, there weren't purpose-built sniper rifles really through the end of the Cold War. I mean, there just weren't. You could argue the SVD was, and I would say you're probably correct, but there was precious few others. And in fact, it's been the flat-top AR which has brought optics up to the state that they are now. If somehow that evolutionary path had not been taken and we were still using carry-handled ARs, I think you would see a lot less use of optics. It would be the same as it was back in the 80s and early 90s before the flat-tops really came out. And that is, you would see people occasionally mounting scopes up there, but again, you are very high over the bore axis. It makes it a very unbalanced and kind of clunky package to have a heavy scope up that high. So they wouldn't have been that popular. But the flat top AR has made these things immensely popular. And the detachable carry handle, I mean, you can buy those detachable carry handles for like, what, $20, $25, you know? I mean, they just don't cost anything now because nobody ever uses them. When was the last time you saw an AR that somebody was firing that had a detachable carry handle sights that he was using? And the answer is you really don't. You almost always see, you used to see the flat top M4 AR and it would have a optical sight on it, and then it would have the pop-up rear sight, because you always had the front sight was the standard front sight post. Then they went to having the gas block front sight that was kind of a rail, that you had one that could pop up there too. And then now you notice they don't even put them on. They're just not even putting on the pop-up sights, although I still think it's a great idea to have them, and I have them on one of my ARs, because I think it's just good to have it there. I just can't have a rifle without some sort of iron sights, even if it's the cheesy pop-up ones that nobody likes. Everybody says the Magpul ones, oh, they break, they're terrible. You know what? Mine's never broken, and it's not terrible. It just sits down there out of the way. And when I need it, I just hit that little lever, and it pops right up, and it's co-witnessed with the EOTech on top of the rifle. So, hey, there you are. You know, it's certainly for close range, it's perfectly usable. So, you know, and actually I've actually practiced with it, you know, shooting at steel or shooting at silhouettes by leaving the EOTech off, just popping up the sight and using the pop-up rear sight with the front sight. And there you go. It works fine. So I think optics, I think people are going way overboard on optics. I think that the problem is they're creating rifles that for defensive use are designed for too long a range and not the close range, and it'll be interesting to see where this goes. There may be a counter, you know, it'll be interesting. Will there be a counter revolution in iron sights? I think that's possible. I think that's possible, especially if two things would have to happen for that to take place, at least a small counter revolution. One would be that essentially it makes the gun sleeker and lighter and more usable, which people would like, especially in some competitions. And if they felt that it didn't slow them down, maybe if there was a slightly different design to the sights and not the standard, you know, aperture and then the front sight with the two side ears on it. Maybe if there was something else that was a little quicker for the eye to acquire, there might be a counter revolution saying, let's get rid of this complexity and let's go with something simple that's going to be more reliable, works, and is just as fast or so nearly as fast that it doesn't really make a difference. That could create a counter revolution, and that would actually be, that would be very cool. That would be very, very cool. Okay, here we are at my favorite part of the podcast, and that is questions and answers. So, the first question I have is actually, it's almost like a follow-on question to a very early one we had about training and trainers. And it kind of fits in with our review of the Gorilla Gunfighter book, which I'm sure anybody who's, well, I'm sure that the people who wrote that book and distributed it don't like very much. But anyway, you can go back a couple podcasts and catch up on that if you didn't. But okay, what's the deal with local trainers versus national trainers? Now, national trainers, I'm talking these well-known guys who are out there. You know, when you think of Gunsight, you think of Thunder Ranch, you think of, oh, there's a bunch of them. There's a bunch. And they vary in quality from very, very good and very professional, like the two I just mentioned, and to down to where there's some chumps that are nationally known, but there's some chumps out there too. You know, I just think you have to look at what they're selling you. And if they're selling you, well, we offer, you know, come train with us. Yeah, come take a course. And then you look and you realize that, hey, I've got to take really three courses to get what I want because I've got to take the basic course, the intermediate course, before I can get to the advanced course. Now, I understand why they do that. They want to make sure everybody in their advanced course has got the prerequisite training to get in. Unfortunately, I don't think they have a way of kind of pre-testing people and say, hey, you know, you don't really need to be in the basic course because, you know, that's where we teach basic gun handling. And why would you want to pay $500, $600, $700 for that, plus a hotel room, plus the ammunition, just to go through stuff that you really kind of already know? But, you know, that's also how they make money. They get people, they don't make money if you come and take a course from them. And even if you go back and say how great they are and a few other people go take the course, no, they make money by selling courses and teaching courses. And they have little staffs. They're like a little miniature college there. You know, they're going to be teaching classes. And what one of the things they need you to do is come there for 4 or 5 courses, or swear this is the greatest place in the world, and do that. So that, you know, that's kind of the shtick with these national guys. You know, I'll leave it to you whether that's worth it. It's worth it for some people to do that. It gives them a sense of, you know, belonging to a loosely organized group of shooters, and you know, that's all fine if that's what you want. Then there are the kind of the traveling trainers, you know, guys who are nationally known, and they kind of travel around, and you get a day, maybe a day or two with them, and it's, you know, at a local range, and or it's whatever that local range has kind of made a deal with them on, as far as what they can do and what they can't do, with vis-a-vis the rules, and you know you get the benefit of a day or two training with them. I think that's a pretty good deal. I know that Fort Scott Munitions, which is south of me, they had Chris Parento, one of the Benghazi guys, and frankly, I just wanted to go down there. I didn't find out about it until it was over, but I would have liked to have gone down there just to shoot with him, just to say I did it, you know, and maybe meet the guy and talk to him, because those guys were pretty good dudes. They were hardcore dudes, and if you ever saw that movie, 13 Hours at Benghazi, yeah, they did it. I mean, those guys, they lost a couple of guys, but boy, oh boy, did they whip on these insurgents that were coming in. And that's an exciting movie. And meet somebody who is a part of that would actually be very, very interesting. So, you know, I think those kind of things are great. How much skill do you pull out of something like that? Well, I'm not sure. Maybe it's just the motivation. Maybe you pick up a couple of pointers, but you pick up motivation saying, yeah, I've done this and I want to continue to kind of do it. Then there are local trainers, and just like national trainers, you can go find guys who are very, very good to guys who are very, very poor. And, you know, I mean, the local reputation will probably tell you everything you need to know. You also, one of the things that I think is important is realizing what is your expectation coming out of it. If the guy's teaching three-gun, how to be in a three-gun match and the best three-gun techniques, and you're looking for more of a martial artist, hey, you know, we're in a grid-down situation and I need to defend myself and I need to know how to go around corners and do this, that, and the other thing, then maybe it's a different, you know, the expectations would be a little bit different and the three-gun class might not be for you. Might be for you, but it might not be for you. So it's looking into the instructor's background and really kind of getting a feel for what they teach. That kind of stuff is pretty valuable, and I think that you know, you definitely have to do your due diligence to do that. So that's my take on the local versus national trainers. The nice part about local trainers are usually the cost is a lot lower, even if they have a class architecture, meaning they got to take the basic, then the intermediate, then the advanced, and things like that. Even if they have that architecture, it's usually a lot less expensive because, especially if you can stay at home and eat your own food rather than having to travel, you know, no travel expense, no hotel expense, none of the meal and necessities, you know, of you need this, you need that, you need laundry soap because after 3 days your clothes all stink, so you need to do some laundry in the evening, you know, stuff like that. So usually the local trainers are a bit more wallet friendly. So that's the deal on trainers. Here's another one. What is the best surplus gun deal out there? And of course there is no single best deal. And again, this came up some guys at work just kind of looking, hey, you know, what's kind of the best deal, best low cost, good quality versus cost. Realizing that if you have almost no cost, you have almost no quality. So where is that happy medium point where you get something? I think there's some cool things out there now. There's still those Tokarev type pistols out there, and basically, you know, they've been imported. And Classic Firearms usually has a selection of those. I like the Tokarev. It's nice. It's a nice thin design. It's the single action, you know, Browning style gun, and a lot of them have had a thumb safety added to them. I do know that they also have some that they've added a trigger safety to, and you know, monkeying around with that. It's all fine if you want to do that. I don't know if there are any Star BMs still out there. I imagine there are. They were selling at I think it was the last of the ones they had, which might have cosmetically been kind of ugly guns. But those were at one point down to $149, and you know, that was a good little 9mm, worked just like a 1911, looked like a little commander, you know, nice little gun. One of the things that's out there now is the Beretta Cheetah, which was an Italian police trade-in. You know, that's $200, $210, something right around there. A 32 ACP with a 12-shot magazine. Not a tiny gun, but, you know, I would trust it more than a High Point. I just would. And even though it's only 32, as opposed to a High Point, which is something else, you know, 9mm, or I think they even make 45s. I think a Beretta Cheetah is much better, especially for older people. Want something in the home that they can defend themselves with, but, you know, aren't looking for a 45, really aren't looking for a 9mm, but they want to have a gun that's good quality and inside there that isn't going to cost a fortune. Hey, that's a decent option if they want an auto pistol. My only concern or reservation with them is I'm not sure that there are a lot of spare magazines available in 32. So unless somebody starts kicking out a few aftermarket ones, I think the pistols come with one magazine. We all know what happens when there's only one of something. It gets lost, and then you have a useless pistol if you can't find a replacement. So before I really would dive into that, I think I would try to find at least one or two other, you know, magazines. That way you're kind of set. But something else that's kind of exciting is, you know, there are some, you know, pretty much pedestrian revolvers out there. And I mean, these things are not Smith & Wessons. They are not Colt Pythons. These are Rock Island revolvers, probably, I think they're probably made overseas. You know, I'm sure they work, and you know, they're not horribly cheap. They're not, you know, terrible. But, you know, for over $200, you get a six-shot 38, which, you know, if it's just going to sit in a drawer loaded or sit in a nightstand loaded waiting for, you know, the potential time it's going to be used, it's perfectly fine for that. Charter Arms makes definitely a couple of revolvers in that category. So, you know, there's some decent low-end revolvers that you can get. If you can get I think it's even better if you can get a used Smith & Wesson, like Model 10 or someplace. But that would kind of be an individual deal. Even when those hit the, you know, the police trade-in type markets, those tend to go for a bit more than these other ones do. But, you know, that's another viable option that takes you away from that, you know, ungodly high point. Or if the revolver is the only option because, you know, some people just don't like semi-automatics. They don't want to rack slides. They don't want to do that. Especially if they have weak hands, and some older people have weak hands and don't really want to, you know, fool with a slide. That's just the way it is. So I would say that those are probably very, very good, very, very good options. And I would rather see one of those rather than a high point, you know, that they can't rack the slide, or again, the magazine somehow got lost, or, you know, you pull the trigger and does it go bang? Well, maybe it will, maybe it won't. I don't know. I don't really like high points, so that's what I say. Okay, the next one, and we've talked about this before. You know, the use of open carry, and this goes back to what one of the first things we talked about, which was Walmart, you know, discouraging open carry. I have to say that just very, very recently, you know, I was in a little restaurant and there was an older man who had to be in his late 70s, if not his early 80s. Very big guy too, probably 6'4", 6'5". And he was open carrying a small 1911, you know, an officer's model thing. And it was, you know, outside his deal. It was there and he was carrying it. And he had a big cowboy hat on, and that was that. He was open carrying. And I do question the wisdom of that. I really question the wisdom of that because, you know, even though he's a pretty big guy, you know, that can be taken away from him. The other thing was, it, while it's still kind of Indian summer in the Midwest, I mean, he could have worn a very light shirt over it, non-tucked in, and you never even would have known it was there. So by just taking a small precaution, he could have, you know, he could have concealed it and nobody would have been any the wiser. Because nobody really looks for a person that age to be carrying, you know, they just don't. They see that they're very well seasoned citizens, and, you know, the fact of the matter is nobody's really thinking that they're going to be carrying. So he would really have the element of surprise. It'd be a lot wiser than open carrying. So I'm not a real open carry fan under any circumstances, unless you're transiting. When I told this story before, when I was a kid, hunting on our own property, you had to transit a county road, you know. And, okay, so you're out on county road, county property. You're not on your own property, but you are, you know, you're moving back and forth. And so, you know, that's a good area where open carry laws protect you, because you're hunting in one area, then you move to another area, and, you know, you can use the county, you can transit the county road. Very convenient. You know, also, if you're taking a gun to the gunsmith or whatever else, you can park in the parking lot and you can take the gun out and carry it into his shop, and, you know, that's legally open carrying, but it works out. It's pretty good. So, you know, there's a lot of these good things happening, whereas, you know, there's a lot of use for open carry. Going into a restaurant or some other place, a store, may not be the best idea. Maybe that's the idea you use when you concealed carry, because that way if you run into some coked up drug head or whatever else, hey, you know, they don't know you're armed, and it's, you have the advantage. You have the element of surprise. So again, that's just another recap of open carry and why that, you know, kind of is the way it is. Okay, and the next one is actually a lot of fun. I don't know if you've seen it, but the Taurus Judge is now in a 7.5-inch barrel. And, you know, frankly, I was looking at it, and I'm actually pretty impressed. I say that, and I'm not a Taurus guy. I mean, we have one of the 22 rifles, and it's really nice. You know, it's at pump action. Yeah, it's a lot of fun. Great rifle. I tried to buy a Tracker one time, and I've told this story. The two they had sitting in the display case had problems, and in my opinion, weren't even usable. So they both needed to go back for their wonderful lifetime warranty. So I'm not really impressed with Taurus. I like the rifle, but I tried to buy the pistol and couldn't do it. It was actually very good fortune because I wound up finding a great deal on a Smith & Wesson Model 28, which is a much better gun and better for what I wanted it for. But to get back to the task at hand, the Taurus 7.5-inch barrel, you know, pretty impressive. I'm pretty sure it's still a 5-shot, and it can take 45 Colt and 410. And I was thinking, you know, for a great gun, and they make other barrel lengths too. They started out with really short ones, and then they've got a 5-inch, 4 or 5-inch. But I like the 7.5. I think, you know, it gives you a good revolver to use in the woods or in the outdoors, and I really like it. I think it's very, very interesting. You know, when you're dealing with stuff like raccoons or maybe some other animals that are creating mayhem, you know, having that 410 as opposed to shooting a solid projectile, that's something that's pretty good. Same thing for snakes. I think it's kind of overkill for snakes, but you know, that's still good snake protection. Now, if you're down in the Everglades where they've been catching 30-foot pythons lately, maybe it's a little light for that. I don't know. But, you know, if you could do worse. You could do a lot worse with a 30-foot python and having a Taurus Judge with a 7.5-inch barrel. But the I like it. Where I kind of part ways with them, and I'm not looking to purchase one, but if I were, the first question I'd ask is, well, how am I going to carry this? And are there holsters that can support that long cylinder plus a 7.5-inch barrel without, you know, spending a fortune? Because I still think the Judge is like under sub $400. I may be wrong, but something strikes me that's a sub-$400 pistol. So that's actually, for a 45 Colt revolver, that's a pretty economical package there. And most Taurus guns are, I think they're sub-$400. Now, some of the 454s and some of that are up higher. But, you know, I think that's actually a pretty good price for getting a revolver that would be a great revolver if you have rural property and you're out there traipsing around and, hey, you don't know. Maybe you run into a mountain lion. Maybe you run into a snake. You know, it's nice to have that. Nice to have that kind of versatility. Maybe you run into raccoons. Maybe you run into snakes. Maybe you run into things that you have to dispatch. That'd be a pretty good little gun to have. I think in stainless steel, it's going to have a good weatherproof finish on it. So it's going to have a finish that can take some moisture. And you know, I think that actually makes sense. I don't think they have an adjustable sight on it. That would be a nice thing to have. It'd be nice to have a very rugged adjustable sight. But I think what it has is just that groove sight. So, you know, those are okay, but they don't really float my boat. I think a good adjustable sight would be a lot better. And as far as loads, I think you can take any kind of modern load. I would not go with plus P or plus P plus or super hot hand loads or Ruger only hand loads. I wouldn't do any of that. I would take the standard factory jacketed bullet loads, I think is about as far as I would go with that. And You know, I think you'd have a very, very good and a very, very capable woods gun there. And, you know, there it's like I said, the long cylinder makes it a little bulky. But to me, the key is you've got to have a holster that goes with it. And I think those guys should actually even put out a holster combo with that. Maybe a Kydex one and then also a leather one. You know, kind of the leather one would be a full flap field holster that wouldn't be fancy, but it would be decent quality, unlike the crap in Walmart. It would be decent quality so that you could put it on a belt and, hey, you can be Indiana Jones and going through the brush and everything else with that, and it's going to protect the gun. And all you got to do is flip up the flap and it's accessible. Or have a Kydex that would go clip onto the belt and go from there. So I would have both of those as options for holsters, maybe even sell them in a package, who knows. And that would be a very, very neat trail gun. Well, that closes up this episode of Old School Guns. Remember, we're on Podbean, we're on iTunes, and somehow we're on YouTube. So anyway, go ahead and hit subscribe, hit like, hit whatever button you can. Tell your friends. If you hate the show, tell your friends. If you love the show, tell your friends. We definitely like to hear from you, like to hear from them. And any comments that you have, you can go ahead and write on the, especially Podbean is really good with that. Go ahead and write it there and I will get to it. But until then, this is Old School Guns. Out.